I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Today, a Haitian judge recommended that those 10 American missionaries detained in Haiti be released. Yesterday, the parents of 10 of the 33 children the missionaries were attempting to bring into the Dominican Republic told the judge they'd willingly turn their children over to the Americans because they had no food or water, and they pleaded for their release. Well, Hiram Sasser, an attorney representing Jim Allen, one of the Americans, says that helped.
The judge did a thorough investigation. And the testimony of the Haitians who testified yesterday really exonerated Jim and the others.
You'll remember that the missionaries, most of whom belong to an Idaho-based Baptist church, were arrested while trying to take children across the border to the Dominican Republic 17 days after the earthquake. They were accused of readying the children for adoption, even though they had parents. The five men and five women denied any wrongdoing. But the case has been a distraction as Haiti tries to cope with the aftermath of the earthquake. And the approach of the rainy season that will mean floods, landslides, and diseases like malaria. And that brings us to our first story today. More than 500,000 people are now living in makeshift housing. This week, Haitian President René Préval said his country urgently needs tents. Who has them? He asked. Well, one man has them and much more in what he calls a shelter box. Tom Henderson is founder of the nonprofit aid organization Shelter Box. He joins us from the group's U.S. offices in Sarasota, Florida. Tom, welcome.
Thank you, Robin.
I'm looking at a picture here, but paint the picture for our listeners. What's in a shelter box?
Well, the clue is in the name, shelter box. It's a big green box the size of two suitcases. When it's full, it weighs about 110, 120 pounds. And in there, there's a 10-person family-sized tent. Additionally to the tent, there's the things you would need if you've lost things in an earthquake. There's a wood-burning stove. There's pots and pans. There's stuff for the children, there's a toolkit, some blankets, that sort of thing, all the very basic equipment.
Mosquito nets, collapsible water containers, thermal blankets, toolkits with hammers and saws, pliers,
absolutely,
wire cutters. And you mentioned things for the kids, coloring books?
Yeah, coloring books. I mean, it's a small part of the inventory, but it's actually a huge impact for the children. And people often forget the children, they're traumatized, and the simple act of giving them a coloring book and a pencil and a bit of paper just really settles them down.
Right.
And for mums and dads in that situation, it's a good thing.
When the boxes are empty, they can be used as a crib or a table or a wheelbarrow. And we understand you tailor the contents of the shelter boxes to the locale in the disaster.
Yes, an earthquake in Haiti at this time of year is different than a flood in Sudan in summer. So we have in our gift to change the inventory of the box to suit the location. For example, you know, in the mountains of Nepal in winter, you won't need mosquito nets, so it might put more blankets in. So it's very versatile.
We have a huge warehouse in Helston, England. You've described it as Walmart for disaster, and we understand when the Haiti earthquake hit, the alarm system went off.
We were moving people within literally 12 minutes. Our friends in the U.S. Picked up on this, and within 24 hours, we had one of our teams on the ground.
And we understand you've delivered about 5,000 boxes to Haiti. And I've got 5,000 more on the way.
Yeah, in fact, more have arrived over the weekend. By the end of next week, we hope to have up to 10,000. That's 5,000 plus another 5,000 in transit. Mm-hmm. And, of course, we're looking well beyond that.
Well, but this costs money. Each box is about, we understand, about $770. And this gets us to how this whole thing started and your partners in this. I understand in 1999 you were watching one of these events on television, and people were having, we've seen this so often, people were having bread thrown at them, and you had a reaction to that. What was it?
Well, it was just a personal reaction, Robin. For me, I just saw these people, you know, being loaves of bread were being thrown on the floor, and I thought these people lost everything. Why should they lose their dignity? And there was a real opportunity to make a difference. So I didn't plan Shelter Box. It happened in a heartbeat. It was an instinctive reaction to try and make a difference.
You went to your Rotary Club. Rotary International has been terrific with campaigns like this. Full disclosure, I was involved with Rotary with an AIDS awareness campaign. They jumped in and put their muscle behind your idea. But still, who pays for the boxes?
Who pays for the boxes? Well, we've got affiliates now all over the world. Not just from Rotary. The majority of our funds actually comes from private individuals, schools, churches, small corporations. So we're very lucky that people out there support us as well as they do.
Well, and then you also have volunteers who go with the boxes to Haiti. And this is so critical because we've seen things, as you said, thrown at people. But you have volunteers who go with the boxes to show them how to use it?
Absolutely. In fact, I've just literally closed the office door. I've got with me two of our response team members, Lasse Peterson, who's based in UK with me. He's literally came back from Haiti. And Dave Eby, one of our United States Shelter Box Response Team operations in the U.S. Wonderful bunch of people. They're volunteers from all over the world. We select them quite vigorously and train them even harder. When it's appropriate, they give of their time and themselves and their life skills to travel with our boxes to make sure they arrive in to the right people at the right time.
Well, we have pictures at our website of virtual tent cities that have sprung up in Haiti, and some of them are your shelter box instant communities. And we'll let people know at our website how they can, if they want to, get involved. That's Tom Henderson. He's founder of the nonprofit relief aid group Shelter Box. Tom, thanks so much.
Thanks, Robin.
Well, this week, the lead coordinator of aid groups in Haiti put out an urgent request for mental health professionals, but he also cautioned that those who come to Haiti must adapt to the culture and the language. Well, science writer Ethan Waters would strongly second that motion. Ethan is author of a new book that concludes that however well-intentioned, the U.S. is exporting our thinking about mental health, and in so doing, actually spreading mental health problems. Sometimes it's indirect. For example, the increase of anorexia in Hong Kong. Young girls there had occasionally expressed feelings of, say, sadness or anger, but they said they just couldn't eat. It wasn't they were refusing to. But after learning about America's anorexia, suddenly girls in Hong Kong were starving themselves to be thin. And sometimes it's pointed, like GlaxoSmithKline's campaign to sell the Japanese on the idea of depression in order to sell them antidepressants like Paxil. Ethan's book is Crazy Like Us, The Globalization of the American Psyche, and he joins us from KQED in San Francisco. Ethan Waters, welcome.
Thank you so much.
And let's just start with a story, because they're fascinating. Anorexia in China. You profile a Dr. Sing Li, an eating disorders expert in China, who worked with the few Chinese anorexics that existed. And then what happened?
You're right. There was a form of anorexia in Hong Kong in the late 80s and early 90s. It was a very rare disorder, and it didn't look like the American form. It didn't have fat phobia. It didn't have body dysmorphia. It wasn't related to dieting or weight loss. Suddenly, in 1994, a young woman died on the streets of downtown Hong Kong, clearly an anorexic. And suddenly the press had to explain what had happened to this young woman. And basically what they did was that they imported the American idea. They went to American experts, American diagnostic manuals, to explain to the Hong Kong public what was this strange disease, who was at risk, what did it mean, what were its causes. After 1994, you saw a rise of the disorder. And not only a rise of the disorder, but a change of form in the disorder. Suddenly it looked more like the American diagnosis of anorexia with all its attendant criteria. So the fear is that we not only export something like anorexia to another culture in terms of our pop culture notions about weight and fashions and so forth, but that the very idea of anorexia itself, when it crosses borders, can become part of the symptom pool of another culture.
The symptom pool, that's part of your theory. It's almost the reverse of what we tend to think. The symptoms are out there, and people can take them on to sort of allow them an opportunity to go through whatever feelings they have. As opposed to, you know, the way we think of it is that the symptoms arise and then you try to find out where the symptoms came from. Are they related to feelings?
That's right. This is much easier to see when you look across time, for instance. So you look, say, to Victorian era Europe, and you see thousands of women manifesting the very remarkable symptoms of hysteria, including things like hysterical leg paralysis. This is not a matter of those women faking their disorder, but it is a matter of their unconscious minds latching on to the language of suffering for that time period. This is culture talking to the unconscious mind. So mental illnesses are real, but they're attached to cultural expressions of them. And the other way to see this, of course, is once you look across culture, you can look to Southeastern Asian males and look at a disorder called Koro, which is this debilitating belief that your genitals are retracting into your body and going
yes.
to cause your death.
Yeah.
Or something like a muck, a mental illness sparked by a moment of social distress or a social insult, followed by a period of brooding, followed by a murderous rage, followed by amnesia. These are all cultural expressions of mental illness. And for some reason, I think in America, we think that we've gotten beyond the culture of mental illnesses, that we've finally arrived at the true scientific expression of PTSD or depression or something like that. But in fact, there is no way to disconnect culture from mental illness. And it will always be shaping our expression. That mind always looks to the culture around it to try to understand what's happening to it, what's going to happen next, what's the likely outcome of these things. And indeed, the people around the mentally ill person do the same thing. And those two forces are very powerful in shaping how a mental illness will eventually express itself and resolve itself.
Let's go back to the young girl in Hong Kong who died and brought anorexia really to the fore. And then, as you say, people started looking at to the West for explanations. What would be an explanation for anorexia if not a concern about weight and eating and your looks?
Well, Sing Lee was trying to answer that question when he was studying those pre-1994 anorexics. You know, they would explain their symptoms in terms of somatic symptoms. They would say, I have a blockage in my throat. The food will not go down. I'm hungry, but I cannot eat, or my stomach is bloated. And it was tied up in psychological family distress often. You know, the Chinese have a very layered and interesting sort of relationship with food. They have their own religious notions that played into this, notions of aestheticism. It had its own cultural meanings and forces. You know, before 1994, after that, it much more shaped itself into an American version. And it's not that in 1994, America suddenly was, or the West was suddenly a presence in Hong Kong. Of course, this was, at the time, a British province. This was a cosmopolitan city. And if you remember also, that was a very nervous time for Hong Kong. This was after Tiananmen Square had happened, but before the handover of sovereignty to the Chinese. There was lots of psychic distress at that time in the population. Into that population suddenly came a notion that one of the ways to express this internal distress is through restricting your eating.
So, Ethan Waters, what are you saying? Are you saying that what many people would say would be well-intended education about something like anorexia or bulimia to let young people know that it's possible to watch out for it is actually acting like a virus?
That's
and
right.
They're catching it?
Exactly, that there is a social contagious aspect to this. And if you ask any eating disorder specialist who does education, they will say, when we go in front of a classroom or in front of a school, we know this is a possibility. And we're very careful not to do a number of things. We're very careful not to put the eating disorder sufferer on the stage. We know never to talk about the celebrity that has it. But when you look to the media in the United States, or the media that happened after that one death in downtown Hong Kong, we do the exact opposite. We always feature the dramatic story. We always feature the celebrity. So it's not necessarily the mental health professionals, but it's how these things play out into popular culture, oftentimes through journalists who are eager for the next syndrome. We love the story of the next syndrome. But in telling the story of the next syndrome, we are part of a process by which these symptoms in our symptom pool change over time.
And again, you say one of the problems of this Western viewpoint is that anorexia, for instance, could tell us a lot about what's actually happening in a culture, but that when we drown individual voices out with this Western narrative about dieting or pop culture, we don't learn that. Ethan Waters' book is called Crazy Like Us. We're going to have more with him after a break. But also, staying on this subject, tomorrow, an American psychiatrist who saw this phenomenon firsthand in Africa.
They're bringing the most advanced scientific psychiatry to Ethiopia. My concern was it didn't feel very applicable.
Tomorrow, back in a minute, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. Today we're speaking with science writer Ethan Waters, author of Crazy Like Us, The Globalization of the American Psyche. And Ethan, we were talking before the break about how American thinking about mental illness can steamroll indigenous thinking. Will you take us to Sri Lanka after the 2004 tsunami? Now, we know that there was this influx of psychological counselors. You spoke with many of them and found that in many cases they did more harm than good. Even though these were well-intentioned people, they went to help people that they presumed would have PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder.
Well, absolutely. We went in with this assumption that we knew that PTSD is a universal thing. But they're actually, you know, the anthropologists know that the reactions to trauma actually do differ across cultures. Meaning matters a great deal. What you think of the event, what you predict your symptoms will be. And it often comes down to really fundamental notions and differences in how you think about the human mind. In America, we think of ourselves as really individualistic, and the mind as being the place that the trauma occurs. And if you ask an American who is suffering from PTSD where their trauma was, they would point to their head. It's in their head. Anthropologists who study people in Sri Lanka, for instance, know that when you ask a Sri Lankan, where does the trauma exist, they'll point to their social circle. They'll say, it is in my inability to fulfill my social role, for instance, or it's in the breakages in my social circle. So it's a different sense of where the self resides.
Well, in fact, when you take people out away from their social circles and bring them to special places where they can be worked with by Western psychologists to get over their trauma, then you're then increasing it.
Well, exactly. So for an American to take time away from their social circle to heal makes perfect sense because it matches our understanding of the mind. For a Sri Lankan to do the same thing, to take time away from their social role to heal, suddenly that is the exact problem they're describing. And neither one of those conceptions are right, but when we rush into another culture with our American notion of PTSD, we often disconnect the hurt individual from their local conceptions of the self, but also from their local conceptions for how to get better, how to heal. You know, I followed an anthropologist all the way down to Zanzibar who was studying how spirit possession notions are wrapped up with their view of schizophrenia. So spirit possession notions are very alive and well in places like Zanzibar. And we as Americans would think that that would be a terribly stigmatizing thing. Well, what you find when you go down to a place like that is that spirit possession notions are often used to keep the ill person within the group. It's not a thing that ostracizes the person. It keeps them within the group. It provides modes and methods of interacting with the ill person that are actually extremely valuable and helpful and filled with kindness and concern. So our idea that it's better to think about mental illnesses in terms of a biomedical idea, that this will reduce stigma, actually, when you study that around the world, it turns out not to be the case. In fact, people that adopt the biomedical notion of mental illness, as true as it might be, are also the people that are likely to believe that the ill person is more unpredictable, more dangerous. They want more social distance from that person.
Perhaps the most explosive story you tell is the one about American big pharma selling the idea of mental health in order to sell drugs. That brings us to Japan and GlaxoSmithKline, which wanted to market antidepressants in Japan. But Japan wasn't a big market for antidepressants because, to begin with, they had no real, even analogous condition to what Americans might describe as depression.
That's right. Big Pharma knew that Japan didn't have a category for depression. They had an idea, a clinical idea of depression, but it was really described a very severe and very rare illness in Japan. And that's not to say that Japan didn't have other forms of sadness. They were just put in different cultural boxes. You can make the case, and anthropologists have, that Japan is indeed a very sad culture, that it embraces the experience of sadness as almost a transcendent state, something you could learn from.
And even when we think of suicides in Japan, suicide is had a very different meaning in Japan.
It did. For an American to think of a suicide, you would almost certainly think, well, this person was depressed or mentally ill. But in Japan, the suicide had a much different history. They called them, you know, suicides of resolve, where it was done for reasons of shame or for reasons of honor. And there was really not the sense that suicide was necessarily connected to a mental illness like depression. That's not to say that American conceptions of depression, when applied to notions of suicide in Japan, might not actually be helpful. I mean, one thing to GlaxoSmithKline's credit, after the introduction of Paxil in Japan, suicide rates have indeed fallen in Japan.
But depression rates have shot up.
But a huge swath of the population now once believed that they were melancholy or sad, now believe that they're mentally ill.
Well, and you speak to many scientists, researchers, doctors who were involved in GlaxoSmithKline's push to achieve this. And they say right up front, they felt that the people at the drug company honestly believed that they had salvation for Japan. But how they went about it, they took out advertising, sort of trying to get the word out that there's such a thing as depression. Tell us some of the other ways that they set the groundwork for people wanting the drug.
They did web-based marketing. They co-opted celebrities in this push. They paid huge amounts of money to very prominent members of the mental health profession in Japan.
Came up with a phrase to describe.
Oh, and they came up with a lovely phrase because, you know, they wanted to counteract this idea that Japan thought of depression as being a severe mental illness. So the phrase that they came up with was that depression was a cold of the soul. So it's no big deal. You take a medication for a cold. You should take a medication when you're depressed. And the Japanese really responded to this over time. And many of the mental health professionals in Japan who were co-opted into this promotion have now, many of them had deep second thoughts.
I can hear people saying, well, wait a second. Antidepressants saved my life here in America. They made it possible for me to function.
That's right.
Why shouldn't the Japanese have that as well?
it's a good argument. We do have advances. My wife is a psychiatrist. She prescribes these drugs. I'm not against quality drugs and sharing them with the rest of the world. We should be sharing our notions of our knowledge of the mind with the rest of the world, but we have to be careful as we do that not to trample upon local notions of the mind that may themselves be very valuable when it comes to, you know, to attaining mental health. We cannot stop globalization. You cannot redraw those boundaries. But at least we could hope that the interchange of ideas about how to achieve mental health are not simply west to east, rich to poor, but that actually go both ways.
Ethan Waters, his book is Crazy Like Us, The Globalization of the American Psyche. Ethan, thank you so much.
Oh, it's been a pleasure to talk to you.
Okay, coming up later today, how the recent snow in D.C. has heated up the political debate over global warming. That's later. The latest news is next, here and now. Protests expected to coincide with the most important national day in Iran's recent history did not materialize, according to the Tehran Bureau website, which monitors Iran from here in the States. Security forces and anti-government protesters did reportedly clash at rallies, but tens of thousands also gathered to hear President Ahmadinejad mark the 31st anniversary of the Islamic Revolution by declaring that Iran is now a nuclear state and lashing out at the West for calling for tougher sanctions on his government. Here's part of that speech today through an interpreter.
The Western wing of hegemony has come to its end, and God willing, in the very near future, this anti-human wing will also break.
Khazra Naji is a special correspondent with the BBC's Persian service. He joins us from London, where he's been monitoring all of this because Iran has barred international journalists. So, Khazra, welcome back. And tell us, what are you hearing about this day?
Well, the latest is there are sporadic clashes in various points and localities in the capital, Tehran. We hear that security forces have opened fire, firing tear gas canisters, and also we hear that sound of firing has been heard in some of these localities. Obviously, there were two lots of demonstrations earlier today. They were pro-government, and the original plan was for the opposition to join those, but the security forces obviously stopped them from joining the main demonstration. So the opposition basically took to demonstrating wherever they could in various parts of the city.
Well, there are reports from the Associated Press that witnesses in Tehran say security forces fired paintballs at some anti-government protesters, that reformist politicians were attacked when they tried to attend a pro-government rally. And it's been so hard to get information. We have to go to blogs, email, Twitter, people like you. But here's a video that was posted online today, reportedly taken at a protest rally. So, Khazra, there have, as you said, been anti-government rallies. But, you know, there was an expectation that there might be more. Do you have a sense of why there wasn't more protest?
Absolutely. I think there was generally a lot of confusion amongst the people in the opposition and the opposition leaders. Originally, they planned to join in with the pro-government demonstrations, and they were going to keep quiet. And then suddenly, sort of when they come to the gathering in front of the actual platform where President Ahmadinejad was supposed to be speaking, they were supposed to show their green colors then and generally take over. And the government forces and authorities were fearing that, and they managed to fill the square where the gathering was supposed to take place with their own supporters, so there was no chance of opposition taking the initiative there.
You're saying that it looks as if the Iranian government anticipated what the protesters were going to do and cut them off.
I think so. And also, don't forget, I mean, the government, the state is using all what it has in terms of force, in terms of imprisonment of potential demonstrators. Dozens of journalists are in jail today. The leaders of the opposition, many of them are in jail. Basically, the opposition has been left without the people who normally organize this kind of thing. And also, the whole various reports that we were getting of people getting arrested in the days leading up to today. One or two people were executed, even a couple of of days ago, there were more reports of people being given execution sentences just today and yesterday. So the government was out there to intimidate and create a climate of fear to prevent people coming out on the streets. And at the same time, they went all the way out to get as many people as possible to bring out in their own pro-government demonstrations. And today we had reports that many of those people taking part were basically school children brought from various schools.
That's Khasra Naji. He's the London-based special correspondent for the BBC's Persian service. By the way, he wrote the book, Ahmadinejad, The Secret History of Iran's Radical Leader. He's been bringing us up to date on events today in Iran. Khasra, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Okay, up next, two massive snowstorms in Washington, D.C. make for a messy mix of politics and science. That's in about 30 seconds. You're listening to Here and Now. The Mid-Atlantic area is digging out again after a 1-2 punch from Mother Nature dumped up to 4 feet of snow over this past week, shutting down the federal government and delighting critics of global warming. Here's Sean Hannity on Fox News.
It's the most severe winter storm in years, which would seem to contradict Al Gore's hysterical global warming theories. Now, I bet the snow even kept Al Gore's jet from taking off.
Then there is global warming denier, the Republican senator from Oklahoma, Jim Inhofe, who built a 6-foot igloo on Capitol Hill with a sign reading Al Gore's new home. But The Daily Show's Jon Stewart fired back on his program last night. A skit equated people who say a snowstorm means no global warming with this guy who thinks darkness means there's no sun.
John, it's dark where I am. Yet just 2 hours ago, it was sunny.
What you're describing is nighttime.
It's dark, and it's only getting darker. This proves global darkening.
Well, some Democratic lawmakers are not laughing. Senator Jeff Bingaman of New Mexico says the snowstorms are going to make it hard to pass any climate legislation in the near future. Joining us from Washington is John Broder of the New York Times. John, you wrote about the political fallout from what's falling, but what do scientists say about the record snow and warming?
Well, I hesitate to characterize the views of all scientists, but I think it's pretty close to a scientific consensus that the planet is heating up. Now, of course, that doesn't preclude the possibility of a cold day or even a monster storm in the eastern part of the United States or anywhere else in the world. That's a weather event. But when you look at climate, which is by definition long-term trends, the temperature of the oceans and the atmosphere is going up.
Well, and we had always understood that global warming was more of a misnomer, that the warming had to do with something that was happening in the atmosphere, and that the result of that would be something more like climate change. In other words, increased storms. Isn't this something that actually scientists who very much believe in global warming have predicted?
It has been, and it's been predicted both in the United Nations reports and in a very recent United States report called Climate Impacts, looking at the longer-term trends of warming of the atmosphere and of the oceans, and significantly, and perhaps in an explanatory way, greater amounts of moisture in the atmosphere, which I'm looking out my window at about 3 feet of it. But we're also seeing more severe droughts in the Southwest and in parts of Africa and Asia. We're seeing more severe hurricanes in the Gulf Coast, and a majority of climate scientists attribute that to the changing climate patterns.
And when you talk about more moisture in the atmosphere, we're to understand that that is a part of global warming, that hotter air can hold more moisture. So when a storm gathers, it has more moisture in it, and it'll have more snow in it as a result.
Well, of course, and I've gotten quite a few letters, as you can imagine, this morning from readers who are saying, well, okay, I will buy the scientists' argument that there's more evaporated moisture in the air, but how come it's not coming down as rain instead of snow? How come it's so cold outside? And the only answer really to that is it's cold in February in the Northeast.
Right.
That hasn't changed.
Right. And anyone who's lived in D.C., as you do, knows that it does get cold in the winter. But by the way, just to give us a sense, what is the city like today?
Well, my street finally got plowed last night. I live in a close-in suburb called Chevy Chase. We didn't see a plow for about 36 hours. I've got to get out and shovel snow around my cars. The federal government is closed. The city government is closed. Most of the metro system is not operating. The buses are not operating at all, and only the underground parts of the metro train system. But the New York Times Bureau is up and running today.
Well, and so are lawmakers' tweets and emails, and they are on one side gleeful, twittering about how the snow means that climate legislation is certainly dead. Democratic Senator Mary Landrieu of Louisiana told The Hill that cap and trade is definitely dead. Majority Leader Harry Reid said the bill is certainly a headache, but Senator Kerry of Massachusetts is trying to rally the troops. Is this an education issue as well? Because it seems like it's much easier to say, see, more snow means no global warming, than it is to say, well, it's complicated, it's global warming, but that is actually leading to climate change, which is predicted to lead to more storms. I mean, it's more complicated on one side of the equation.
This is really a political argument, not a scientific or climatological argument. A lot of the mail I've gotten this morning, you know, is along the lines of, who are you going to believe, a bunch of scientists or your own eyes? It's cold outside and there's a lot of snow. But the political argument over cap and trade really doesn't hinge on one snowstorm or one year of drought. It's a very complicated logarithm of how different states get their energy and what costs will be involved. And if you live on the West Coast and you get a lot of solar power or hydropower, the idea of slapping a large tax on coal is pretty attractive to you. If you live in Ohio or Pennsylvania, heavily dependent on coal and manufacturing, cap and trade is going to look like less of a good bargain.
Well, and you say cap and trade legislation won't hinge on one storm, but there's fear on the Hill that it might. And these storms in Washington come as global warming skeptics feel empowered. There were those leaked emails that led to claims that scientists were stonewalling on questions about their research. There were problems with the 2007 UN report because it was said to exaggerate the rate of melting of Himalayan glaciers. So you say it shouldn't hang on one storm, yet might it?
Well, I really don't think so. I talk to senators involved in this debate and their staffers all the time, and there are a handful, a relatively small number of members of the United States Senate who do not believe that global warming is happening at all, who believe that the United Nations IPCC scientific process is fraudulent or corrupt or both, who were never going to vote for a broad economy-wide piece of climate legislation anyway. Others who very ardently believe the science and believe that there is dangerous man-driven climate change underway are still skeptical about the legislation because of its politics and because of the economics. That's really what the argument is about, not about science.
John Broder of the New York Times from a very snowy Washington, D.C. John, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Thus, the Powerpuff Girls were born, using their ultra-superpowers, Blossom.
What do the Powerpuff Girls have to do with the late French filmmaker Jacques Tati? Well, animator Craig McCracken says, look at the house the girls live in. It's exactly like the home of a family in a classic Tati film.
As soon as I started, I was just like, well, I'm going to make it the Arpels house. So every single episode, there's a slight tribute to Tati.
The Arpels house is the very modern home at the center of the Tati film Mon Oncle, or My Uncle, which won the Best Foreign Film of 1959, and McCracken is one of Tati's many fans. Well, now, My Uncle, Mr. Hulot's Vacation, Playtime, and other films of Jacques Tati are being screened at several retrospectives in the U.S. One's underway right now in Chicago. Another begins later this month here in Boston. Why the attention? Well, it's hard to remember now, but Tati was an international sensation. Here he is being introduced to America on the Steve Allen Show in the late 50s.
Mr. Tati, you are the writer, director, and star of your new picture. Isn't that an awful lot of work?
It really is. It's an awful lot. Yes.
Well, if so, why do you do it?
Well, because nobody'd want to do it.
Tati started as a mime. He became a filmmaker, writer, actor. If America had Charlie Chaplin's Tramp, France had Tati's Mr. Hulot. Now he's the subject of a documentary. Michael House is a filmmaker based in France. His new film is The Magnificent Tati. And Michael, for the uninitiated, what is a Tati film like?
It's something completely different. It's something totally original. It's kind of like a silent film, but it's full of sound.
We're going to speak more about how Tati used sound, but we mentioned that he started as a mime. Explain the physicality of his miming.
Well, Tati began on the stage. I think even more than being a mime, the foundation of a lot of his work is the synergy between the performer and the audience. His miming was based on sports. He was in a rugby club for years, and he would imitate all of his fellow players after the game. And from there, he built an act on all different types of sports.
There was a man on a horse in which Jacques Tati was both the man and the horse.
That was his signature one, that's right.
How did that then surface in his films?
Well, I think that he wasn't a person who read a lot. He didn't tell stories with words. The way that he would get laughs and responses from people just had to do with the body and the situations that people were put in, and he worked that. He wasn't interested in the traditional narrative that film generally follows.
So when two gentlemen lift their hats and say au revoir, you know, there's ballet there, or when someone's just
absolutely
spooning something out of a bowl, right?
Again, from the stage, he, like performers do, they rehearse and they rehearse and they rehearse, and that is exactly what he would do. He would mime to the other people appearing in the films, the other actors, exactly what he wanted them to do. So in many ways, every person that appears in a Tati film is mimicking Tati. So in a strange way, he's playing every role in his films.
Well, and he would also literally play some of the roles. The country postman who on his little battered bike ends up in the Tour de France. Pee Wee Herman did an exact homage of that scene. And then there was Tati's Mr. Hulot in Fedora, carrying an umbrella, a completely different character.
Totally different type of character, comedy character, totally different. Much different than anything people had seen before, because he was someone who wasn't the center. He wasn't the focal point. He wasn't in tune to the gags. He wasn't even a witness to the gags. He was just kind of causing them and then going off screen.
Well, you know, when we say that he was, Jacques Tati was Chaplin, he really wasn't. In fact, in the film, he says he was anti-Chaplin, the opposite of Chaplin.
I think that's absolutely important to get. Chaplin, his movies are, there's almost a light shining on Chaplin in every shot. There's a tension. It's all about the individual. You have to relate to the tramp. Hulot, it's nothing at all like that. He's on the perimeter of the screen most of the time. He's not being clever. He's barely even present. And it just was different. It made you look at the whole screen and look at the world, not so much at the performer. And Hulot encourages you to do that.
Well, he also ultimately built an entire studio outside of Paris to film the film Playtime. What was that about, that idea? Because every image in a Tati film, except when he's in the countryside and, you know, in his early films, but if he's in buildings, every single image is spotless and shining and gleaming, and then you find out later that he probably built it. What was he saying about modern times?
I think that Tati was, of course, he was interested in the platform of the modern world, I think, obviously, but he was mostly interested in how human beings interact with their surroundings. And in Mon Oncle and Playtime, clearly, you know, he's talking about there's one way, the old-fashioned way of living, and then there's the new way of living. But when you watch Playtime, yeah, it's this pristine, perfect picture, every shot. And it is extraordinary, the extremes he went to.
One of the things that building some of these sets did is enable him to control the sound. Sound was so important. You went to visit a Foley artist, Michael Kowalski of Dodge College of Film and Art. He shows you how Tati might have inserted the sound for dropping a pitcher.
Everything you hear in a Tati film is made afterwards in a studio. And Kowalski was amazing. He basically deconstructed an iconic scene from Mon Oncle for me and said, okay, the first thing he would have had to do was he would have done the footsteps.
Separately, you would do what's called the props, which it would be the bouncing of this pitcher. A little higher.
Every noise in there is thought through and planned out, and they go to just extremes. And it gave me a new idea in my head how to enjoy Tati's films, because I really started to listen after that to the layers and layers of sounds and how they're very similar to real life, but a little over the top.
This obsession almost with detail, some would say, was his downfall, because he went into debt over building that huge studio. He made some other films afterwards, but what would you say about the end of his career?
I think you're right. I think that Tati, He was an artist. He was a creator, first and foremost. He wasn't a businessman. He had the independent spirit of an artist. In the industry of cinema, you know, you kind of have to become a producer to realize all these things. And in all fairness, I don't think he was that great of a businessman, and he stuck his neck out way too far for his artistic, you know, dreams. But he did achieve something incredible, and that was that film Playtime. And I think that, you know, all the risks that he took and all the gambles, I know for a fact he was very satisfied with Playtime. It did destroy his freedom as an artist because he couldn't rally any more support in the last part of his life to make more films with the kind of freedom he had with Playtime because it didn't make any money. Mm. But I think he was satisfied. I think he did make a film that is truly unusual and beautiful and different and offers the potential of what film could be or the cinematic experience could be. And I think he knew that. I think he wanted everyone to like it, and he tried, you know, his hardest to make it accessible. But at the same time, he was trying to say, hey, if you go to the movies, there's a lot more that you can experience than just beginning, middle, and end. There's a lot more. And here, look at my film. This has a lot going on.
Every frame, something in the foreground, something in the middle, something in the background, as we said, no close-ups. In fact, in your film, you speak with someone who says that Tati was ahead of his time.
Definitely.
And today's multitaskers would actually find it a lot easier to look at Playtime than maybe those did then.
I totally agree. I think that he was a little bit of a prophet. Young people, particularly that play video games and stuff, if they were to sit down at Playtime on a big TV or in a theater, they would probably really, really enjoy it because there's a lot to see.
We've been speaking to Michael House, a filmmaker based in Paris. His new film is called The Magnificent Tati, The Life of the Late Legendary French Filmmaker Jacques Tati. Michael, thanks so much for talking to us about it.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.